Pain in Paradise by Anna Tikva. Chapter 1. Cleaning Up the Damage. With a quiet whir, the huge dome lids slid apart and down into their base. For a week, Paradise had been slowly draining and drying out from the accidental flood. It was now a sad mess of rutted hills and farmland. Many uprooted trees and a few buildings were drifting in the dirty lake. Where there had once been fine white sand along the beach, there were now unsightly piles of mud, silt, and dead plants. All of the tinies, and the animals which had survived, were sheltering in the old nursery. "I'm still not exactly sure what set off the emergency response," the professor lamented, as he donned a new pair of disposable gloves. He climbed into his lift pod and pressed the up arrow. "I thought I had installed a fail-proof system. I'm surprised that such a minor impact would cause a sensor to malfunction." Evan, who was Professor LeMann's only assistant, glanced up with a wry smile. "Did you expect projectiles?" Observing Paradise from high up in the lift pod, the aging professor shook his head. "I can't understand why any of the tinies would foolishly damage their beautiful world," he moaned, "especially when such damage affects their own existence." "I just don't think they thought it through," Evan replied. "Odin and Ponsey wanted to see what would happen. They hoped to catch a glimpse of you just to confirm you are real." Jax LeMann shook his head. "As if it's not enough that a train comes in every day with supplies, a rainmaker waters the gardens at night, and they know that Louis talks to me." "I'm sure they will have learned from this," his tall assistant encouraged, watching the lift pod take the gray-haired professor down into the ravaged dome. "Being sent back to the nursery to live on Wonder Drink is a worthy consequence for their reckless actions." They both chuckled, knowing Odin and Ponsey well. Examining the sensors near the North Forest, the professor found one with a small black mark on the outside. "Looks like a direct hit here," he called out, taking it off and handing it to his assistant. Evan passed him a new sensor and took the old one away. It was a bright day outside, and sunshine shone in through the glass walls of the rainforest biome. Even though it was the 2nd of January and minus 20 degrees Celsius outside, the solar heat penetrating through the glass dome during the last week had helped to dry out the muddy ruins of Paradise. The air circulation system had also been of great assistance. "Thanks for coming in today," the professor said to Evan. "I want to be here," Evan smiled. "I had a nice New Year's celebration with my parents, but yesterday was fairly boring. I had nothing planned for today."
"Or for the rest of the week, or the next?"
"I'll be here, Jax," Evan assured his mentor, picking up the gardening tools. "I want to help restore Paradise." Wiping the sweat from his brow, the professor smiled gratefully. "I'm very happy to hear that," he exclaimed. "You certainly won't have any time to be bored." Evan passed him the gardening tools, and the professor began scraping piles of mud off the meadow and repacking it on the hills. He had a few ferns in his pocket to insert by the tall cliff, which he put in with great pleasure. Standing outside the dome, Evan used a long-handled grabber tool to fish out trees that had ended up in the lake. Still green and alive, the trees were replanted by the professor. Several that had been uprooted near the hills had dried out. Sadly, he piled those trees to compost in an unfrequented part of the Rainbow Hill Forest. For the first hour, the two scientists worked without much conversation. Seeing their beautiful, well-designed world so devastated by the flood was distressing and deeply painful. The water runoff had eroded the base of the tall hills and carved deep canyons through the green farmland. "Unbelievable how a little water can drastically change the landscape overnight," Evan commented, marveling at the layers of mud, silt, and debris on the beach. The professor groaned in response. "Sa alors. And yet it's nothing compared to that tsunami in southern Mexico. We only lost one dog and some of the animals that the tinies couldn't capture. They lost over 10,000 lives." Evan nodded, positioning his tool to reach for another floating fruit tree. The devastating tsunami had hit a week before on Christmas Day and was still featured in the leading news stories. Everyone was talking about the rescue attempts and the extent of the damage. "I listened to an interesting report last night," Evan remarked, releasing an apple tree close to the professor. "Apparently, if the mangrove forests along the coast hadn't been drained and dug out to build resorts and refineries, the loss of life would have been much less." "I must have heard the same report," the professor muttered, "and I also heard that they didn't have an early warning system in place. I'm sure that will change in the future."
As he said this, he reflected sadly on the fact that his dead phone had been an unforeseen flaw in their well-planned system. No doubt, he added, some lessons will be learned. We must respect the environment and rethink human habitation in high-risk areas. So true, Evan replied, pulling out another tree from the lake with his long-handled tool and passing it to the professor. I was also appalled at the corruption graph, he added. It showed conclusively that natural disasters destroy far more lives in countries where the governments are corrupt. For sure, the professor agreed, picking up the miniature fruit tree and replanting it in the orchard. And like they said, if we all lived in tents, earthquakes wouldn't kill so many people. If we moved to the hills, we'd be safe from tsunamis. However, I still maintain that if there was a god, he could have found a way to save all those people. Pausing from the work, Evan queried, if God saved humanity from every foolish mistake, would we learn responsibility? Maybe not, the professor admitted, but it would give us evidence that he is real. Would we notice? Evan considered. How do we know that a god of some sort hasn't saved this world from several fatal asteroid collisions or redirected hurricanes and tsunamis away from populated areas in the past? The professor didn't answer. Thinking over a recent discussion he'd had with Seth, Evan continued, it's interesting to ponder that in countries where the governments are known to be corrupt, people don't expect the leaders to solve all their problems. It's often quite the opposite. Oppressed people are more likely to turn to some concept of a god and pray for help. Most are desperate to believe in an afterlife. But in Western countries, we've begun to rely more and more on the governments and human ingenuity to solve all our problems. We expect life to go well and be fair, and governments to provide. It's here that we've developed the ideas that the Christian God is indifferent, evil, unjust, or even non-existent. You'd think those who suffer the most would be more against a God concept, but often it's the other way around. Evan, Jax chided, I've concluded the God of the Old Testament is evil and unjust based on his own records, and that in itself determines that Christian theology is a fable. God doesn't exist. He's simply a clever invention to control the masses. Evan didn't answer. But he also didn't fully agree with the professor's conclusions. Was the God that Seth worshipped evil and unjust? Was the professor a better leader than the Christian God? Did Jax have the authority to determine good from evil? Did anyone have such authority? Would morality keep changing from year to year based on social demands for equality, fairness, and human rights? For a few minutes, they were both silent, completely absorbed in scraping the piles of mud off the beach and pulling out fruit trees. With careful precision, the tall blonde scientist manipulated his grabber tool to take hold of a floating mango tree. Jax cleared his throat. Louis has been doing a lot of reading at night in the nursery, he said. What is he reading? My book. Surprise, Evan clarified. Faith or Fact, An End to Delusion? How did he get hold of your book? Looking at the dirty beach, Jax remarked, Oh la la, we're going to need a few more bags of clean sand. What a mess. Scooping up mud to fill the ruts in the meadow, he explained, Louis has lots of extra time since they've all been confined to the nursery. He's been in his private office every night, looking up stuff on the smartphone. He did a Google search on my name and discovered I'd written a book. He asked if he could read it, so I sent him a digital copy. Be hard for him to understand, Evan frowned. You use a lot of scientific terms that he would be completely unfamiliar with. Yes, no doubt he will find it confusing in places, Jax admitted, but he'll get enough out of it to ensure he isn't misled by foolish notions of any god figure. There's a lot of ridiculous stuff online. Or it will make him curious, Evan suggested. If he were Odin, Ponzi, or Franz, I'd expect him to immediately search out the opposite, Jax chuckled. But Louis trusts me implicitly. As they slowly made repairs and cleaned up the damage, Evan wondered if Louis's implicit trust was a good attribute. Wasn't the scientific method to investigate the evidence and consider all possibilities before making firm conclusions? Wasn't some level of skepticism helpful to avoid being misled? Changing the subject, Evan said, I'm thankful you started all the new baby animals when you did. The new pets have given the tinies an exciting distraction in the nursery. Hopefully all the handling will result in tamer animals. The professor smiled. Who would have known, he replied. But yes, it is good timing. It has given the teens something to do. It's also been the perfect opportunity to dispose of the old ducks and chickens before the tinies had to witness their demise. What? Evan questioned, surprised by this news. They were at the end of their lives, the professor explained. The tinies had to watch them all die one after another. It would have caused a lot of grief. But you can't stop them from seeing death, Evan argued. No, of course not, the professor assured him. But I might as well diminish the suffering when I can, don't you think? That's our goal, an ideal world with minimal suffering. Only for the humans? Looking up kindly, Jack Slamans implored, Evan, I used a very humane, gentle euthanasia. It's far better to die comfortably than wither away in old age. Evan tried to process this unsettling information. He wondered if the farmers would be upset. After all, they had risked their lives to save the chickens. As they continued the cleanup process, the professor mused, I am surprised that none of the miniaturized mammals have been able to reproduce on their own. But maybe that is for the best. Evan nodded. So far, none of the animals or birds had produced offspring. The birds laid eggs in a normal fashion, but none of those eggs ever hatched into chicks. Had reproduction occurred, the Paradise Project might have become self-sustaining, which would be enjoyable in many ways, but would also have major long-term implications. With his tool, Evan picked up Louis's house that had been floating in the lake. Oh no, it's growing mold, he remarked with dismay. I guess we'll have to throw it out. Better check the others, the professor grimaced, shaking his head sadly. The farmhouse was moldy, and so was the store. One by one, Evan had to remove all the houses. Anything that had come in contact with mold spores from the ground had developed the plague. Even the mansion on the hill has mold, Evan despaired when he examined it carefully. And I thought the houses on the hills would be fine. The humidity levels skyrocketed, the professor acknowledged. We'll need to remove all the buildings, he sighed. Allures. But perhaps we can bleach them and put them on display. I'm sure everyone will want to see what the tinies were able to build for themselves. Some of these homes were exceptionally well built. Yes, Zahira Milan's home is outstanding, Evan agreed, pulling it out of the forest with his handy tool. They put so much detail into their windows and veranda. And look at all the little railings on the steps. The professor looked and smiled. I'd give a prize to the Orchard Girl's house as well, he said. Both are very well made. Evan carefully positioned all the houses on the professor's desk. Heading toward the north end of the dome, he dangled his tool over the edge and pulled Ponzi's little shack off Cascading Mountain. He looked for Odin's poorly designed cabin, but it was now only a pile of sticks strewn through the forest. This is going to be a big disappointment to the tinies, the professor sighed, glancing over at the houses now lining his desk. They will have to start all over again. Maybe we should consider a different building material. Suddenly, Evan remembered the model homes he had seen months ago in his subdivision display. Hey, did you ever take a look at the link I sent you a while back? He asked. You know, the link with the little model homes? Looking at him blankly, the professor tried to recall such a message. About 50 kilometers from here, there was a display of miniature homes, Evan explained, as he pulled furniture out of the small moldy buildings. I've never seen such well-crafted models. I don't know if they would fit the tinies, or even if they are for sale, or even if you'd want them to have homes that they didn't build themselves. For a few minutes, the professor didn't answer. Thoughtfully, he continued scraping piles of mud off the beach and resurfacing the landscape. Evan piled the fairy furniture into a plastic tub so that he could scrub all the pieces in hot, soapy water. Good thing this furniture is made of metal, he said. We should be able to use it again. Picking up a tiny pair of shorts, he added, The clothing can be washed as well, but I'd recommend we cut up fresh bedding and towels. Can you please resend that link? The professor asked. Sure. Evan dried his hands and fetched his phone from the desk. He scrolled back through 3 months' worth of conversations and finally found the message from his parents. He resent the link. Then clicking on the link himself, he took it over to show the professor. Holding his phone out over the edge of the retracted dome lids, Evan pointed to his screen. What do you think? Will they fit? or do you think these houses are too modern for paradise? Examining the picture carefully, the professor deliberated. They might be just the right size. It will change the natural look. But no doubt the Tinies will be thrilled to have such luxurious homes. With a puzzled frown, he looked over at Evan. But will it be beneficial? Or is it better for them to rebuild and develop their skills? Well, why don't I phone the company and see if these houses are even available, Evan encouraged, thinking it would be a lot of work and time for the Tinies to rebuild. The model homes may not be for sale, or they may be too small. Yes, please do. While the professor continued to resurface the furrowed landscape, Evan phoned Timberlane Construction. He explained his interest in buying the small model homes for an important university project. Oh, I'm sorry, these model homes are still part of an ongoing display, the secretary told him. We have another subdivision going in after this one with the same style. Oh, that's too bad. But we may have another set, she reflected thoughtfully. Just 1 minute. About 5 minutes went past while Evan stayed on hold, watching the professor reposition parts of the stone pathway that had been washed away. Some of the rocks were tangled up with mangled sunflowers, which the professor pulled out and tossed into a large compost bin. The secretary returned and asked, "Would you be interested in some model log homes?" "Without doubt," Evan replied, astonished. "Timberlane used to specialize in Muskoka log homes," she explained. "We have several models available of all shapes and sizes." "Just one question," Evan begged. "How high are the doorways?" He was put on hold again while the secretary went to check. When she returned to say that the doorways were about 10 centimeters tall, Evan could hardly contain his excitement. "And the price?" "My boss said that depending on the size of the buildings, he would sell them for around $100 each." Evan relayed the information to the professor.
"Tell her we'll be over to look at them in an hour,"
the professor replied, "if that's okay." Hearing his response, the secretary agreed. "That's fine," she said. "See you then." Chapter 2. New Homes and New Plans. After a drive into the city, the professor and Evan purchased 7 little log homes. Some were only 1 story high and very plain. Others were multi-leveled with open windows, dormers, decks and verandas, chimneys, fake copper plumbing, and fancy front doors. Just like the models Evan had first seen, they had a hinged front, which pulled open to allow customers to view the full interior. As the secretary helped load the log homes into the professor's SUV, the cold winter winds whipped across their faces. "January is not my favorite month," Jax complained. Pulling up her hood and tucking her cold hands into her pockets, the secretary asked, "Just out of interest, what do you plan to do with all these houses?" "They are for a woodland display," the professor announced immediately. "In the biosphere?" she questioned with a smile. Sometimes being well-known had its drawbacks. "Well, for sure," the professor replied a little sharply. "Fairy gardens are the in thing at the moment." He smiled and asked, "Don't you think it would be lovely to have a fairy garden display?" "That would be so nice," she exclaimed. "I'll be over to see it as soon as it's ready." "Come visit this summer and you'll see." Twilight had descended once they were settled in the SUV. Evan looked over in the dim lighting. "June? July?" he questioned with great surprise. "Do you think paradise will be ready for a public viewing so soon?" The professor didn't answer. He was still ecstatic about the purchases. "Oh la la, this is almost too good to be true," he sang out happily, starting the engine. "What an amazing surprise this will be for the Tinies." Turning up the heat high and the seat warmers on, Evan agreed. "These log homes will look quite natural in paradise." "I am so happy," the professor exclaimed, as he backed out of the parking lot. In the dusky light, his lined face seemed to exude its own radiance. "You really enjoy making the Tinies happy, don't you?" Evan observed. Driving onto the highway, the professor confessed, "It's the greatest happiness I've ever known." "It is fun," Evan agreed, feeling his own excitement over the well-built homes. Then he thought about it a little more. How do we decide who gets what? Will we position the homes where they were before? There was a momentary pause as the professor considered the question. Yes, we'll position them corresponding to the size and location of the originals as best we can. They passed a large sign advertising the Greenville University Biosphere with its slogan, "Your Awesome, Evolving World." Glancing briefly over at Evan, the professor told him, "I'm aiming for paradise to be on display this summer, maybe even late spring if possible." "Summer is only 6 months away," Evan pondered as he sped along the highway. "Will the showing be for scientists only, or the public as well?" After some quiet deliberation, the professor replied, "Why don't we aim to invite the scientists during the exam week in April? I can arrange for my exams to be written on the first day, and then I'll be free. We can open paradise to the public in May. I believe once we tell the world about our venture, everyone will want to see it." Evan chuckled. "I'm sure it will be the most popular display." "I believe so."
"Then we only have 4 months to get our fairy garden ready."
"Some will call it that," Jack smiled. Evan rolled his eyes.
"So I'd say that 3 or 4 months is about right. The Tinies will be in their late teens by then."
Pondering this information, Evan relayed, "Which will make them young adults, approximately 18 years old in our time frame." He looked over at the professor with one eyebrow raised in mock alarm. "You realize we're heading into teen issues? Will this be a good time to put them on display? Why don't we wait until they are at least 25? "These are the best months of their lives," the professor insisted. "My teen years were fabulous. If they follow their hearts, they'll work it all out." Evan was not so sure. "Follow their hearts," he frowned. "Emotions do make life exciting, but are they good leaders? There are likely to be authority issues, fierce competition, hormonal swings, boy and girl dramas," he pointed out. "Perhaps even..." Non, the professor interrupted merrily as they drove through the open gates of the Greenville University. "Not in a place like paradise. There are a few challengers in the group, for sure, but they are all good kids. I'm sure Odin and Ponzi and Franz will mature and direct their energy into healthy skepticism and experiments that improve their world." "We have 10 young men and only 9 girls," Evan reminded him. "That's a potential problem right there. Someone is going to feel that life is very unfair." "You worry too much," the professor laughed, stopping at a red light. "Louis has been fine on his own. Don't think so negatively. Imagine being a teenager in their innocent surroundings with tame animals, a perfect climate, an abundance of good food and free time, an amazing uncle as their role model, and no unnecessary restrictive rules. How could anyone be unhappy for long?" A little snow began falling from the dark sky. The professor turned on his wiper blades. It was only 5:30 on that wintry January evening, but night had already fallen. With a quizzical look, Evan questioned, "Were your teen years always fun?" He well remembered his own unhappy high school days. With his deep interest in academics and lack of ability in the sporting world, his adolescence had been full of loneliness and ridicule. For some strange reason, the two girls he had liked never seemed to value the amount of time he spent on schoolwork and major assignments. There might have been the odd disappointment here and there, the professor admitted, as they passed a large waterfall near the Arctic biome. Beautiful colored lights lit up the tumbling falls in ever-changing colors. "I grew up with everything I wanted and more," he relayed. I don't remember any tragedies or deprivations." He paused as they drove along the well-lit road that weaved through the various biomes. Silvery Christmas decorations wound around every carriage lamp, made for a delightful festive display. When the professor spoke again, his voice was low. "I didn't face tragedy until much later in life." With a deep sigh, he added more cheerfully, "The Tinies will be the happiest teens ever." Evan looked over with compassion. Little by little, he was beginning to appreciate the professor's terrible loss and understand the pain he carried deep inside. As they approached the university campus with the large rainforest biome glowing brightly in the distance, Evan was still not convinced that the Tinies should go on show in their teen years. He remarked, "Well, at the very least, there are some attitudes that need improvement before we attract the nation's attention. I shudder to think of the negative press reports we'll have to deal with and the committees who will want to enforce their opinions on everything from diet to world views. The professor chuckled. Yes, yes, we're in for some interesting times. But there will also be glowing reports and lots of excitement. We've created a fabulous world, and soon even Rachel will be part of our team. Louis is a model servant leader. I couldn't imagine a better uncle. Most of the kids love learning and building and life. Imagine how popular Zaheer and Amy's songs will be. Imagine when everyone sees how well the trade system works and how happy the Tinies are go-karting down the hill. Imagine how popular Paradise will be with the children and families who visit the biosphere. Ooh la la, I'm sure we will have parents begging to donate embryos to this project. And then, think how delighted the Tinies will be to raise children, not just puppies and kittens. Evan felt the professor was overly optimistic. He was also alarmed to think of the project extending beyond the Tinies they already had. We'll have to ensure we've accounted for all the ethical questions that will be asked, he reminded his mentor. We likely won't be allowed to proceed any further. The Greenville University Ethics Committee may shut us down. By the way, he asked anxiously, do the Tinies have rights? Will we get in trouble for viewing them without their consent? Should we get them to sign a form of some sort? Driving past the university buildings, the professor looked at him thoughtfully. I think we have a good case for this project to be classified under naturalistic observation. You see, if the Tinies knew that they were being watched, they might modify their behaviors, which would alter the results dramatically. If this project is to have any value to our understanding of psychology, sociology, and contribute towards our goal of improving human life, we must keep them unaware that we are observing them from day to day. I know, Evan reasoned anxiously. I just worry about what the ethics committee will say when they find out. It seems to me that a consent form of some sort is required. I am their guardian, the professor reminded him. In fact, I would see myself as their father. A father can give consent on his children's behalf until they are 18. That's still 3 months away. And technically speaking, on a normal time frame, they are only a year and a half. Tousling his messy hair, Evan thought carefully. Look, Jax, he said finally, I know we are likely to get into big trouble for this project at some point, unless some very, very beneficial research comes from it all. But I don't want to undermine anyone's trust, especially not the Tinies. Now that they are in their teens, how about we at least explain to them that they are part of a research project, a project to make a better world? We should properly inform them that we are watching some of the time. After a few moments of silence, Jack shrugged. I suppose, he said. We can tell them that they have been specially created to be a part of a better world. It's a privilege. Evan flinched at the word created. They were designed to be part of a better world, he clarified. And yes, it is a privilege, although maybe not the incredible privilege I once thought it would be. Are you still with me on this? Jax inquired thoughtfully as he drove into the staff parking lot. Do you want out? No, I'm with you, Jax, Evan protested. I just want to do things right, at least as right as we can when we've already overstepped the bounds, he sighed. Would you like to explain it to them? Yes, Evan nodded. I would like to share what we can. Then you have my permission, the professor smiled. Parking beside the only other vehicle in the parking lot, Jax glanced briefly at the car. Rachel's still here, he observed anxiously. Best to bring the houses in through the secret exit. Rachel was the main animal doctor for the entire Greenville Biosphere Complex. She often worked late if one of the animals or birds needed extra attention.
When Evan and Jax stepped out, they were blasted by the cold north winds.
Loudly, the professor called out, Hey, maybe when we do the courage ceremony, you can explain it all then. Evan nodded, shivering a little as they opened the back of the vehicle to take out the houses. Since the terrible night when the flood had occurred, they had talked a lot about praising the brave Tinies who had helped others. Small, specially designed gold chains and medallions had already been delivered. Lifting the biggest house out of the back, the professor added, Acknowledging their bravery and kindness will encourage more good deeds. With their heads bent down against the harsh wind, they quickly unloaded all the houses outside in the darkness, placing them beside the hidden one-way exit door. Running around the brightly lit biome, they came inside through the front. Rachel was coming out of the animal care center when they reached the professor's office door. "You're back again," she smiled. Her blue eyes twinkled with curiosity. "Don't you ever take holidays?" "You're still here too," Jack smiled. "We all practically live here some days." "Yes, but I'm heading home for dinner," the lovely dark-haired veterinarian laughed. "What are you up to, Jax? I'm so curious."
"It will all be revealed in April," he promised firmly. Evan raised his eyebrows.
"Oh, so there's finally a date," she smiled. "I'll put it on my calendar."
Saying goodnight, Rachel exited through the back doors. As soon as Rachel was gone, the scientists took the drop floor into the basement labs and waited down in the secret tunnel with their eyes on the closed-circuit TV. They watched as Rachel came to her car, only she didn't get in. Noticing the fresh footprints that led to the exit, the animal doctor curiously followed them. Jax and Evan groaned as she bent down to examine the small model log homes.
"What must she be thinking?" Jax chuckled. "That we've gone insane," Evan muttered.
Once Rachel had returned to her car and driven out of the parking lot, the two men brought the houses in one by one, up the tunnel and into the paradise room. They spent the rest of the evening happily positioning the houses on secure foundations inside the dome and filling the rooms with clean furniture and bedding. It gave them great pleasure to imagine the happiness such luxury would bring.
Chapter 3. The Courage Ceremony. Certain that the Tinies would be able to return to paradise the very next day, Evan and the professor decided to hold the Courage Ceremony on the last night in the nursery. Uncle Louis told all the Tinies to shower and put on clean clothes. It was to be a special occasion. The news that they would see Evan again ignited great excitement. No one had seen Evan since they had first entered paradise, nearly 5 months before. Around 7 that evening, Evan opened the creaky doors of the laboratory, turned on the lights, and stood in front of the common room window. Most of the Tinies raced up to the glass joyfully. However, Odin, Poncy, and Fran stood by the back wall with their arms folded across their chests.
"It's so good to see you again," many voices called out. "We love you, Evan."
"I missed you so much," Amy called out wistfully. "And thanks for trying to restore paradise. I love our beautiful world. I can't wait to go home."
Many thank yous were echoed all around. The touching responses brought tears to Evan's eyes. He hadn't realized how sentimental he would feel communicating with the Tinies once again. Sitting nearby, out of view, Jack Lamons was also wiping his face with a tissue.
Sienna was looking up at Evan with her big, dark eyes.
"I miss seeing you so, so much," Sienna told him earnestly.
"Well, I haven't stopped seeing any of you," Evan told them with a smile. All the Tinies instantly stopped talking and looked up with interest.
"When have you seen us?" Damien wanted to know.
"How do you see us?" Franz demanded. All the Tinies wanted to know the answers.
"When you were in paradise," the tall researcher began with a smile, "do you ever notice that some of the sky is clear and some of it is hazy?" Thinking it over, most of them nodded their heads.
"Well, I can see you in the hazy sky," he explained. "It's not hazy for me. It's as clear as this glass window in the nursery on my side."
"So you live in another world then, don't you?" Odin challenged.
"Yes," Evan nodded. "You live in the world of the Tinies, and I live in the world of the Bigs."
"And you can see anything that we do?" Poncy questioned uneasily.
"If you are outside, I can see you," Evan clarified. "But I may not always be looking. Often I am somewhere else."
"Can you see us in our houses?" Sienna asked.
"No," Evan shook his head. "If you are inside any building, I can't see you."
"Can the professor look through the haze?" Odin prodded.
"The professor and I can both look at you as long as you are outside," Evan answered.
"So why didn't you help us sooner when we were having the flood?" Damien challenged, folding his arms across his chest.
"That was a very unfortunate incident," Evan agreed sadly. Both of us deeply apologized for letting you all down. The professor and I were in other places that evening and didn't see what was happening, or we could have stopped the water much sooner. But we were there to see many brave actions that took place when the water was high.
How big is your world? Franz inquired.
Far, far bigger than yours, Evan told him. Odin came a little closer.
Can we see your world? He demanded curiously.
No, not at this point, Evan told him, but maybe someday you will.
Why not now?
Because you need to learn many other things before you can learn about our world.
So you can look at us, but we can't look at you, Odin smirked. That isn't fair.
Maybe not, Evan agreed. But one day you will understand why it's this way. For now, you just need to trust me.
Where's the professor? Odin called out. Why can we see you, but not him?
Yeah, is he real? Lima asked. Evan tried to explain. The professor chooses to be unseen for now. One day, you may see him. Trust me, without him, you wouldn't be alive and you wouldn't have a beautiful world to live in. As I've told you before, he is the mastermind of paradise. I am only his helper.
Odin shook his head. That doesn't make any sense. He's more important than you, but he won't let us see him. Something's wrong with this story.
Paradise is a very special project created for some important scientific research, Evan divulged. The professor and I are experimenting to see if human beings are happier living in a perfect world. You have all been specially designed for this purpose. You wouldn't be alive at all had this project not taken place. This is a unique privilege.
Odin huffed in a disgruntled manner. Unique privilege, he mumbled. That's what you want us to believe. I don't trust you.
Do you have reason not to trust me? Evan asked.
Folding his arms together, Odin thought hard, but he struggled to find a reason.
With the tiny necklaces in his hand, Evan said, I'm here tonight to present some awards to those who showed great bravery during the flood. Looking over at Louis, he said, I'll put these in the boys' delivery area and you can give them out as we go along. Uncle Louis ran into the boys' room to receive the goods. Evan opened a small door on his side, placing the gold chains inside the sliding compartment. Once everything was in Uncle Louis's hands, Odin asked,
Are there others in your world?
Of course there are, Evan assured him. It's a very big world. Thinking of one more thing he thought was important to relay, he said, Sometimes we share pictures of you or your songs. Many of the tinies exchanged awestruck glances.
Are you drawing pictures of us? Kenzie asked curiously, pressing his freckled face close to the glass.
All eyes looked up at Evan for the answer. Evan shook his head. In our world, we have a device that can instantly draw a very realistic picture.
Can we see one of those pictures? Zahir asked.
Yes, just one second, I'll get one, Evan told him. He raced up to the supply room and picked up a cute photo of 20 tinies lying in beds drinking from bottles. The cuteness factor was overwhelming. The tinies raved about their younger selves. Even Odin was curious. Eventually, Evan cleared his throat and began. During the flood, the professor and I were very pleased to see so many of you work together to save lives. Louis, you were on your own for many hours, and you stayed calm and used your good sense to direct several life-saving measures. You made sure that everyone got to higher elevation. You had the wisdom to call the boats over early on. You jumped in to save Vahid, even though you aren't the strongest swimmer yourself. As a side note, Evan added quietly, We'd suggest you might want to work on that. But tonight, he smiled proudly, we are giving you the finest star medallion. Santa and Amy came forward to help Uncle Louis sort the medallions. Amy found the star and lovingly put it around Uncle Louis's neck. Calling Lima, Zahir, and Kenzie forward, Evan praised them for rescuing everyone in their boats. You had the bravery to take those boats out into the raging water, and you successfully saved other tinies, Evan said, looking at the three young men with pride. Without your boats, we may have lost Uncle Louis, Charlie, and Vahid.
And the chickens, Charlie piped up proudly. Then he mumbled, even if they've moved on to a new phase.
Evan didn't reply. Charlie was using the explanation they had passed on to Louis. He hoped no one else would mention the chickens. Nodding to the eager female helpers, he said, You will find three shining moons for these brave lads.
Amy and Santa found the medallions, and with happy smiles they adorned the young men. Everyone clapped. Then Evan singled out Damien, saying, "We're giving you the gold heart, Damien. You showed great selflessness and courage trying to rescue Maxie." With a proud smile for the tall, golden-haired youth, Evan added, "That was a very dangerous mission. We were so thankful to see you surface." Damien smiled and nodded. "I just barely made it." Amy placed the gold heart around Damien's neck.
"I'm so glad you did," she whispered.
There were still two shining moons in the box. Uncle Louie picked them up and looked at the girls.
Evan chuckled.
"Not only were the boys brave," he continued, "but if it were not for two courageous young ladies, Damien might have spent the night bobbing up and down in the lake. Amy and Santa, the shining moons are for you." Uncle Louie slid the gold chains over the girls' heads, and they looked up with happy delight. "My rescuers," Damien smiled. "I sure was glad to see you." Everyone clapped for everyone, although there were some envious glances from those who had not received an award. Evan told them the gold chains were to be visible reminders of courage and selfless acts. Long-haired, stocky Odin had been brooding, and he suddenly spoke up, looking in Evan's direction. "I know why I shouldn't trust you," he said. "You call it a hazy sky, but it's actually glass, just like the glass of this window. It goes ping when the stones hit it. You aren't telling us all the important details." The other Tinies didn't agree that this was a strong case against Evan. "He's not telling us something that is false," Zaheer argued. "He's telling us what we need to know. He's already said he will tell us more in the future." There were several other questions about when they would return to paradise, what had survived, what had not, was it still muddy, and such like. Finally, Evan assured them that they might re-enter paradise in the next day or two, and then he said good night. Chapter 4, Hiding Truth. "It's so fun sleeping all together," Amy giggled as she pulled up the soft blanket and curled inside. "It's a girls' sleepover party every night." "It is cozy," Tina agreed, stretching out on her thick piece of foam that lay on the floor. "But I miss paradise so much." Even though they had been confined to the nursery for 3 weeks and were missing the open space, the greenery, the lake, and the delicious food, there had been some enjoyable substitutions. It had been really fun tending to the baby animals every morning. They had developed close relationships with their new pets. During the afternoons, there were lots of craft supplies in the cupboards, interesting books, building blocks, and components to make cars with wheels and other moving machines. Sleeping together in one room had been a great way for all the girls to reconnect and talk through their grief over losing Rosa. They had also discussed fashion, food, pet names, hairstyles, house improvements, and played numerous guessing games night after night. No longer did anyone feel the need to run to Uncle Louie when they woke up in the dark. "I hope one day I'll get a necklace because I'm brave," Tina said wistfully. "Uncle Louie definitely deserved the finest star reward," Amy acknowledged. "He saved everyone. I love the star medallion he was given." Georgia added, "Zaheer and Kenzie deserve the moons. They were so brave, rescuing everyone in their boats." "They were very brave," Vanitha agreed. "And Lima," Santa piped up, "he got a moon too, and so did Amy and me." "Right. All five of you got medals," Georgia recalled without enthusiasm. "Is that the first time Lima has done something good?" Santa and Lily objected, but they weren't able to remember any other specific incidents. "He worked really hard on the road," Amy acknowledged. "The Beach Boys have done some good things too," Vanitha spoke up quietly. "I'm glad Damien got the gold heart. He almost lost his life trying to save Maxie." "He did," Amy agreed earnestly. "He showed he has a heart of gold, just like Evan said." "And you rescued him," Georgia called out rather enviously. "You and Santa, the only girls who got medals." Running her finger over the crescent moon on her gold chain, Amy smiled in the dark. She was quite pleased with her special award and recognition, and she knew Santa was too. She also liked the idea that the professor and Evan were watching over them. It made her feel safe.
"I'll never get a medal," Dia mourned. "I'm afraid of everything. I'm even afraid of the dark. All I can see at night is that red glow over there. I don't like red glows."
"I don't either," Lily agreed. But then with a happy sigh, she said,
"Just think, in paradise, we can see sparkling moonlight on the water and little twinkling stars up in the skies. It's so pretty. I really hope we go back home tomorrow."
"Nothing is better than paradise," Amy murmured dreamily. "I love hearing the loons cry out at night and seeing fireflies flashing in the dark." There were audible sighs of happiness as everyone recalled their own favorite memories of paradise and the sights and sounds that they loved.
"I miss the taste of fresh mangoes," Santa laughed, clapping her hands together excitedly, "and juicy cucumbers and sweet tomatoes and crunchy carrots."
"And I miss cooking," Nancy lamented. "I love having something to do every day, something important that everyone needs and enjoys."
"I definitely miss eating delicious food," Tina piped up, "but I'm glad I don't have to cook it."
Most of the girls laughed in agreement.
"And I miss the beautiful flowers," Vanitha added, "and the wonderful fragrance that wafts across the gardens. I could sit out in those gardens for hours."
Enjoying the lovely reverie, Amy spoke up.
"And I love sitting on the pier with my legs dangling in the cool, refreshing water, watching the Beach Boys practice surfing."
"All of them, or just Damien?" Georgia giggled.
"What do you mean?" Amy asked, blushing in the darkness as she sat up to braid her long copper-brown hair.
It was beginning to turn curly and became quite wild if she didn't braid it. In her haste to climb into bed, she had forgotten.
"Come on," Santa teased gently. "You love Damien. You're always trying to get his attention."
Suddenly, Amy felt exposed. She hadn't realized her feelings for Damien were so obvious to the others. He was very attractive in many ways and most likely her favorite, but she wasn't quite sure he would choose her.
"Oh, no, he's just a friend," she replied evasively.
"Really?" Vanitha asked in surprise. Georgia piped up again.
"Amy, you belong with Damien. You rescued him. You're the best singer, and Damien's the best at everything else."
Many of the girls laughed, but Amy didn't. Clapping a catchy beat on the floor with her hands, several girls agreed.
"He's perfect for you, Amy," Georgia said.
"What about Zaheer?" Lily piped up.
"I think Amy loves Zaheer. They sing together, and he's almost as good-looking as Damien. It just depends if you like blonde-haired guys with big muscles or dark, lean, and..."
"But Zaheer is so serious," Georgia spoke up quickly, "and not as athletic as Damien."
"Zaheer is just a friend, too," Amy replied, speaking more truthfully as she wrapped ribbons around her long braids.
The dark-haired young man with whom she loved to sing was a good friend and nice to have around, but he didn't shine so brightly as Damien.
"I like everyone in paradise," she protested.
"Well, almost."
"Not everyone is fully likable," Tina said quietly. The others agreed.
"So does anyone like or love a guy?" Santa giggled. There were a few nervous laughs.
"Well, I love Charlie," Santa said proudly. Then she beat her black fists on the floor in a rhythmic fashion, saying, "Charlie is mine, and don't anyone dare to try and take him."
No one was surprised that Santa loved Charlie. She had given her new puppy to him and had always been his best friend. Everyone agreed to leave Charlie to Santa.
"I really like Milan," Nancy said quietly, almost too quietly to be heard.
"You love Milan?" Santa repeated loudly, glad to have a friend who was willing to share.
Nancy quickly hushed her. "Don't want the guys to hear this," she whispered.
"Okay, everyone," Santa announced in a quieter voice. "Milan and Charlie are taken. Any other claims?"
Tina spoke up. "I wish I could talk to Vahid. He seems really nice, but whenever I'm near him, I can't think of anything to say, and he doesn't say anything to me."
"Well, are there any other takers for Vahid?" Santa inquired. She paused to see if anyone would speak up. No one did.
"Then we should all try to help you make friends with him," she declared.
I love Poncy, Lily whispered meekly, but he doesn't notice me.
He doesn't notice anyone, Santa said. You can do better than Poncy. Several girls agreed.
But maybe he'll be nicer if he has a friend, Lily pleaded, a friend other than Odin.
Poncy is trouble, Santa told her.
He saved me from the spider, Lily protested. He was really brave. He didn't get a necklace, but he got a flag.
There were murmurs of disagreement all around, but Lily was undeterred. The conversation continued quite late that night, but no one else would admit to any likes or loves, even though plenty of likes and loves were suspected.
Well, I think we should have a rule between us all, Santa said at last.
We aren't supposed to have rules, Lily argued. The professor doesn't like rules.
He doesn't have to know about this one, Santa laughed.
What is it? Georgia inquired cautiously.
Santa announced her rule quietly.
I think that if any of us tells the others that we really like one of the guys, then that guy belongs to the girl who makes the first claim.
Amy was unsure.
But what if we like them and they don't like us back? She asked. Does the rule still apply?
The rule applies, Santa stated dogmatically, unless the guy makes it very clear that he doesn't like the girl. But as long as she likes him and he wants to hang around with her, then the claim stands. No one else can interfere.
Warily, Amy inquired,
what do you mean by interfere?
You can't spend time alone with someone else's guy or hug them, Santa began.
Or tell them that you love them, Georgia added, or try to make them your special friend.
But what if two girls really like the same guy at the very same time? Lily asked.
Santa paused to consider the dilemma.
We'll deal with that if it happens, she decided. Right now, only a few of us have said that we really like somebody, and no one likes the same person.
As everyone mulled the idea over, Santa prodded, so are we all in agreement then? No one said that they weren't, and many were beginning to yawn.
Okay, Santa said, so from now on, if you want to make a claim, you have to tell the rest of us that you really like someone, then he's yours.
Amy didn't feel comfortable about the new rule. However, no one had spoken up claiming Damien, or even Zaheer. She felt quite safe concealing her feelings for the time being.
Oh, and one more thing, Santa added. This rule is a secret between the girls only. No one else is to find out about it.
Unless, she added, someone really needs to know for one reason or another, then we can tell them. Most of the girls nodded their assent wearily, too sleepy to care. It took Amy a long time to fall asleep as she pondered if and why anyone else would need to know about the rule. Many confusing thoughts whirled about her head. Somehow the rule didn't seem quite right. However, Santa was her best friend, and Amy didn't want to go against her. Surely it would all work out.
Chapter 5. The Last Day in the Nursery. When Uncle Louis banged on the Wonder Drink machine the next morning to wake everyone up, the girls straggled out looking very tired.
"What's with you girls this morning?" Uncle Louis asked curiously as they yawned and stretched.
"We had a very late chat," Amy told him.
"Yeah, we heard you," Poncy replied, rolling his eyes.
Looking up with a terrified expression on her little freckled face, Lily asked quietly, "You did?"
"Yes," Poncy reiterated, pretending to be very upset. "You made so much noise that I kept waking up."
All the girls looked at each other.
"What did you hear?" Amy inquired anxiously.
Bronze-skinned and dark-haired, with rather flexible facial features, Poncy could make the most comical expressions. Cocking one eyebrow and looking like he was about to reveal a terrible secret, he began with a whisper that turned quite loud.
"Giggling and snoring!"
The girls broke out laughing in relief. Poncy just shook his head amicably and headed for the Wonder Drink machine. The color began to return to Lily's white face. Finishing off a cup of the special formula, Santa sang out,
I know what Wonder Drink tastes like.
What? Amy asked.
Dreamily, Santa replied, it tastes like ripe mangoes mixed with strawberries and bananas.
Zahir looked at her thoughtfully.
And a squeeze of lemon, he added.
No way, Santa told him. There's no lemon. That would make it sour.
Maybe a little orange juice, Charlie suggested, setting down his cup. But Santa didn't agree.
Definitely fried fish, Ponsy grinned. There were many gagging sounds from the girls, and then the suggestions became even sillier. Once he had finished breakfast, it was time for the morning pet care sessions. The young teenagers headed into the animal and bird nurseries to visit their new little friends. The pet nursery was a rectangular area much longer than their own rooms, and it was divided into 8 subsections with screen doors between each compartment. Every chamber had a separate sliding door on the far side that the professor and Evan could access. Each compartment in the animal and bird nurseries had a formula machine, but instead of push buttons and a spout, these machines had pink tubular attachments called teats. In the first section, 3 little lambs were frisking around. The older sheep were enjoying a turn at the formula machine, sucking the rubber teats greedily. Just like the tiny humans, the animals had no alternative food source in the nursery, only the perfectly formulated drink that was nourishing for them all. Kenzie and Vanitha were holding lambs in their arms and rubbing their woolly heads. Isn't he the cutest? The young farmer called out to the girls. Amy came over and patted Kenzie's little lamb. It bleated softly. So cute, she agreed, smiling. But I love my bird the best.
Sheep are smelly, Georgia remarked, wrinkling her nose and refusing to come closer. I would never want a smelly pet.
That's mean, Vanitha exclaimed, holding her lamb closer. Leaving the first chamber, the girls opened the screen door and walked into the next section, where a young black and white calf was hungrily sucking on one of the rubber teats. Brownie the cow mooed loudly when she saw the girls and nuzzled Charlie, who was cleaning her up. He laughed and stroked her neck. Brownie is missing all the delicious grass, he smiled. She hopes she's heading back to paradise soon.
Don't we all? Georgia exclaimed.
Might be today, Lily reminded them. That's what Evan said. All the Tinies looked at each other with hope. Evan hadn't been completely certain, but he had indicated their return would be soon. Opening the next screen door, the girls walked into the stall which held the 3 fawns and the 2 older deer. Over the last 3 weeks, the older deer had slowly warmed up to the girls and no longer backed the fawns into a corner when they came in. Lily and Amy picked up the shovels and scooped out the overnight messes into a large pail. Georgia headed to the next chamber. Deer were smelly too, so she had given her fawn to Amy. When the girls were done, they set the pail of poop inside the sliding door on the far side of the room. One conveyor belt took waste out of the nursery, while another brought clean pails back in. From a large depository on the wall, Amy tugged out 3 wet wipes and handed one to her friend. "We should name our pets," she said as she began wiping her fawn with a wet cloth. "I'm going to call mine Zoe. Isn't that a nice name?"
"Then I'll call mine Zilly," Lily decided.
"Zilly and Zoe," Amy mulled over. "What should we call the other?"
"What about Zeddy?" Lily suggested.
"Zilly, Zoe, and Zeddy. I love it." Amy agreed. Vanitha overheard the names as she walked past to visit her kitten.
"Hey, that's cute," she said. "I'm going to think of something like that for our babies."
Before long, the kittens were named Mia, Mimi, and Muffy. When the girls had cleaned and patted their deer, they put the dirty wipes into another pail, which they set inside the sliding doors as well. They checked to see the feeding tubes were still working well, and then they moved on to see their birds. First, they had to pass through a screen door into the puppy chamber. Damien, Milan, Santa, and Charlie were playing with their new pets. Damien wanted to show everyone that his new retriever could fetch a ball when he threw it. The girls stopped to watch. "Emma's way smarter than Fredo," Damien claimed. Amy was surprised by the comment. She thought both were smart. Charlie was pleased that he and Santa had taught his little beagle to bark any time they carried in a rabbit or a squirrel. Milan had been teaching his red lab to sit and stay, but he waited quietly until the girls had moved on before resuming his training. The quiet, blonde-haired store assistant did not like to be the center of attention. In the next room, which was the rodent chamber,
Zaheer sat on the floor playing with the frisky squirrels he'd adopted. His black hair was thick and wavy, and in the dim lighting, his skin looked very dark. Georgie stood against the wall. She had been chatting to him. Fredo had followed his master into the rodent chamber and lay next to Zaheer with his head on his lap. One squirrel was enamored with Zaheer's medallion and was trying to clasp it with its tiny paws. Little rabbits hopped back and forth between his lap and the formula teats that were fixed on the floor at their level. The jealous dog kept trying to nose the smaller animals out of the way. "No, Fredo," Zaheer said firmly. "These are your friends now. You have to look after them with me." The squirrels chattered, taunting Fredo. An audible groan escaped from the old golden retriever. "Have you named your squirrels yet?" Amy asked. "No," Zaheer replied. "Have you named your deer?" Lily told him merrily, "Zilly, Zoe, and Zeddy." Zaheer laughed and his gentle blue eyes twinkled. "Really?" "Yes, I love their names," Amy smiled. Does make them easy to remember," he considered. Beautiful Georgia stooped down to pat one of the squirrels. Her soft blonde hair was so long that when she bent over, it hung all the way to the floor. "Want to hold one?" Zaheer asked, passing a little squirrel up to her. "Sure," Georgia smiled as she slid down to sit beside him. She eagerly accepted the baby. "Your pets don't smell bad." Opening another screen door, Amy and Lily moved on towards the bird chamber. Georgia stayed where she was. They passed by the three kittens in the cat chamber. Ripple was lying beside the kittens and probing them curiously with her paws. Amy watched Ripple teasing the tiny kittens. "Let's put Ripple in with the dog," she said. "I don't like that gleam in her eyes." "I'll take her out," Lily offered, scooping the big orange cat up in her arms. "The dogs will keep her in line." The bird chamber wasn't the last chamber, but it was the last one the tinies could enter. A locked screen door kept the final chamber for insects separate from all the others. It was dark and hard to see inside, but today they could hear bees buzzing around. Reaching the birds, Amy opened the screen door. 40 small feathered chicks of various breeds ran over to her and began to peck at her feet. It wasn't a pleasant sensation.
"No, no," Amy laughed. "You've got the wrong food here."
Quickly, she scooped up some of the bird mush that sat in an open spout on the floor and reminded the chicks what they were supposed to eat. Once the chicks were pecking in the right place, Amy turned her attention to her pet bird. Like the other babies in the bird nursery, it was fully feathered and learning to use its wings. Lily rejoined her, and their pets swooped over to land on their shoulders. George's bluebird, Skye, flew into a corner. She wasn't as tame. The loon chicks and ducklings huddled in the corner as well.
"I still don't get where all the big chickens went," Lily remarked. "One day they were here, and the next day they were gone."
Patting her lorikeet softly on the head, Amy nodded.
"Charlie says that Uncle Louie said that the professor took them on to the next phase."
"Whatever that means," Lily frowned.
"It sounds important," Amy reflected without much concern. She wasn't as attached to the chickens as she was to all the other animals.
No one really understood what the next phase meant, but the explanation sufficed. There were so many new babies to enjoy that even Charlie didn't give it much thought. Taking a small glob of mush on her finger, Amy fed it to her rainbow lorikeet as she had done many times before.
"There you go, colors," she said.
Lily fed her cardinal flash. The bird swallowed quickly and squawked for more. For a while, the two girls had fun playing with all the birds. Amy loved watching them fly back and forth between their nests and their fingers. Skye was shyer. It always took some coaxing before she joined in. Amy marveled that the little birds were learning to fly all on their own. It seemed like such an incredible skill. After a while, George's little eastern bluebird began to swoop around anxiously.
"Here, Skye," Amy said, holding out her hand with some mush. "I'll take you to your girl."
With colors on her shoulder and Skye on her finger, Amy re-entered the rodent chamber. Lily followed her with Flash perched on her head. Nancy was also in the room looking after her rabbits. Skye flew to George's shoulder as soon as he saw her.
"There's my little birdie," Georgie said, smiling, as the bluebird sang brightly to her.
She handed the baby squirrel back to Zaheer and stood up. "I don't think we're going to name the animals," Zaheer remarked. Amy and Lily looked over.
"Well, I can't really tell them apart," he said with a laugh, gesturing toward the three identical rodents in his lap. "So how will we ever know who is who?" "But I taught them a noise." Zaheer whistled and all the little red squirrels looked up at him instantly.
I love it, Amy laughed.
It was George's idea, Zaheer admitted. After another enjoyable hour going back and forth between all the animals, Uncle Louie called them for lunch. Feeling hungry, Amy didn't have to be called twice. She took Colors back to his chamber and headed out of the nursery. As she lined up to wash her hands in the common room sink, she saw Damien shove Zaheer, and Zaheer shoved him back.
I'll wash my hands if I want to, Damien grumbled, bypassing the lineup for the sink. I don't need your reminders, little Louie.
Zaheer shrugged, and his face darkened. Although Amy agreed that it was important to wash hands after they had been handling the animals, she kept quiet. Sometimes the other tinies didn't wash their hands, and sometimes they got sick, and sometimes they were fine. It didn't always equate.
Damien was rarely sick.
Having just heard from Franz something that Uncle Louie had told him, Odin's voice rang out loudly.
Are you serious? He complained, looking at Uncle Louie with intense dismay in his pale blue eyes. When we get back to paradise, we will still need Wonder Drink.
Just for a week or two, Uncle Louie nodded, his eyes on the book he was examining for their next school lesson. When we get back to paradise, we will begin growing our own food again, but it may take a while for the crops to grow and begin producing. Odin stormed off to the Wonder Drink machine. He pushed Quiet Vahid aside and filled his cup for lunch. Angrily tossing back his long, tangled blonde hair, he pounded the nearby wall with his fist.
I hate this stupid nursery, he yelled. I'm never coming back here again.
Then he stomped into the boys' room.
If you hadn't destroyed paradise, Lima called out loudly, none of us would be stuck here. You can only blame yourself.
Yeah, Damien agreed. You should tell him that, Uncle Louie. Smoothing his completely white beard, Uncle Louie looked up from his book and shook his head. Having communicated over the phone with the professor in his private room in the nursery, they had already talked this through. The professor says we aren't to hold this against Odin and Potsy, he told the tinies firmly. Hopefully they have learned from the mistake and won't ever do something so foolish again.
You mean you aren't going to make them build another road like we had to? Lima prodded, shaking his black fist in Odin's direction. That doesn't seem fair. Making a flood that ruins our world is a much bigger deal than stealing a few mangoes and knocking Charlie down.
Uncle Louie shook his head.
You intended to steal the mangoes and push Charlie down, he told Lima, and you broke two rules.
Odin and Ponzi acted foolishly, but they didn't break rules or plan to cause a flood.
Lima shook his head. But Zaheer overheard them plotting to do damage.
I understand what you're saying, Lima, Uncle Louie empathized. It doesn't seem fair, but we have to let this one go. Rolling his eyes in dismay, Lima was visibly upset.
It isn't fair, Damien decreed.
Uncle Louie looked over at the two tall young men and tried to explain. Decision has been made by the mastermind of paradise, he said firmly, and we all need to get on with the next step of our journey. At any moment now, we'll be allowed back into a fully restored world. We're starting over, and we can be thankful that the professor and Evan did all the cleanup for us. The Beach Boys kept grumbling as they helped themselves to more Wonder Drink.
Pouring herself a cup of formula, Amy wandered over to the display board that held all the best artwork they had done as tinies.
Uncle Louie hadn't kept everything, or all the walls would be lined with pictures. Benita and George's masterpieces outnumbered the rest. At the beginning of the display were wild scribbles of color that didn't look like anything. Next were a few crude images of smiling faces atop two sticks for legs. Unlike the others, Benita and George's first drawings of people also included round circle bodies. Some of their early writing was also on display. Amy was quite proud of her early penmanship. She had copied words from a book and formed the letters well. She had been so proud when Uncle Louie had promptly put her printing up on display. Even Uncle Louie had drawn some pictures when they enjoyed art time in the nursery. One big picture showed him carrying five tiny children who were drinking from formula cups, while 10 more were trying to hold on to his legs. Some were pictured crying, while others were trying to show him a toy. In the background, two were wrestling and three were happily playing with dolls. Amy happily remembered those days. She was sure that she was one of the little ones Uncle Louie was carrying, the copper-haired girl with her arm around his neck. The blonde-haired tiny beside her was Georgia. She decided that Santa and Zaheer and Lima were the others he had wrapped in his over-exaggerated long arms.
"We liked cuddling with Uncle Louis," she recalled wistfully. "And that must be Odin and Pontsy fighting in the background," she deduced. "Probably Vanitha, Yu Yan, and Tina are playing with the dolls. Damien is trying to show everyone the big tower he built." As she carried on examining the old pictures, she saw the older Tiny approach the art table behind her. Vanitha and Georgia had finished lunch early and were at their favorite activities. Vanitha was playing with the clay, creating wonderful pots and sculptures. Georgia was working on her book, coloring a picture of all the Tinies standing on a muddy hill. "You almost have your book done," Uncle Louis said proudly, having watched her make a new picture every day. Carefully applying a brown marker to most of the landscape, Georgia smiled. "Yes, I'm almost finished. This is my last page." "Does it have a title yet?" he asked. Amy turned around to listen. Everyone had been interested in the progress of Georgia's first book. Picking up her pile of folded papers, Georgia turned to the front page. She pointed to the fancy big letters that adorned a picture of seven proud Tinies wearing medals. It said, "Heroes of the Big Flood." Uncle Louis nodded with admiration. "Well done, Georgia," he said. "This will be a very special keepsake for everyone. You've done beautiful drawings." "Vanitha helped me draw the faces," Georgia admitted. "You are both wonderful artists," Uncle Louis praised. Tina piped up. "Your next book should be A Perfect Day in Paradise." "No way," Odin disagreed, coming out of the boys' room. "That would be so boring. How about Spider Heroes?" "I'll do that one eventually," Georgia agreed. "But first I'm doing The Day We Saw the Rainbow." Uncle Louis smiled. "When you girls get a chance, I have a special project for you." "What is it?" they both asked. "I want you to make a large clay tablet about 2 arms tall and 1 arm wide," he explained, demonstrating the dimensions as he spoke. "On the tablet, I want you to write our 2 rules for paradise. No hurting anyone and no stealing. When we get back home, we'll put this tablet by the store for everyone to see and remember." "Okay," the girls agreed. "Make it as beautiful as you want," he told them. "Just be sure that it's very easy to read the writing." "Vanitha should write it then," Georgia declared. "She has the best handwriting." Smiling at Georgia, Vanitha said, "Then you should do the decorations." A cloth ball came flying through the air and hit Uncle Louis in the head. Loud laughter convicted the perpetrators. "Guys, make yourselves a target on the wall and practice on that," he directed, throwing the ball back. "Ah," Odin whined, "it's more fun to hit people." "If you want to launch balls at each other, go ahead," Uncle Louis replied wearily, thankful that 3 weeks of managing all the Tinies in such a confined space was almost at an end. "But if you hit someone who hasn't agreed to be part of your game, you'll have to dismantle the catapult." Grumbling, the young men aimed their catapult toward a wall.